us a mini lecture just so you see what you can expect from the department. And later on at the very end, there will be someone from careers, as I said, to speak to you a bit more about careers. So I'll just give it to Stephen, really, so he can start. Thank you so much for staying.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you so much for all of you showing up here. This is actually a larger crowd than I expected. And in fact, you can tell by the lack of seating here. But what I want to do in this lecture is to basically give you a sense of why we have this discipline called sociology. And it has to do with the fact that societies exist. And you may think, oh, well, that's obvious. Well, it's not so obvious. Some of the parents in the room might know this, of course, but maybe younger people don't know it, that in 1987, Margaret Thatcher gave an interview to a women's magazine where she said there's no such thing as society, okay? And all there is, are relations among people and families and the communities that they're part of, okay? And in a sense, what the role of the state was, this was an argument about having a kind of smaller state, was to actually let those people get on with their business, right? So in other words, there is no such thing as society in any kind of larger sense. And so the thing that we actually try to do in sociology is to kind of tell you what it means to think about society in a larger sense, because we actually believe such a thing exists. And I think, one of the things that you'll get, especially when you take the first year courses, is you'll get some kind of historical sense about where did we come to have this idea of society. Because the idea of society that we're talking about here is indeed quite a big notion. It's not just the community, it's not just your family, right? But in a sense, this is where the state does come in, right? It's the fact that you, in some sense, are relating to a larger group of people, right? Many of whom you will not know personally, most of whom you will not know personally. In fact, they're far-flung. Again, think about a kind of nation state like the UK. People are living everywhere, yet there's some sense in which we're all interconnected in terms of a set of laws, a set of common expectations of how, let's say, you behave towards strangers when you're on a train going somewhere, right? All of that stuff actually has to be constructed, right? That stuff just doesn't come naturally, okay? One of the things that's very striking, which gives you the sense in which a society exists, is the extent to which we actually deal in a very civil way with strangers. People we've never met before, right? We're not suspicious, we're not fearful. We presuppose that there's some kind of common understanding or some kind of common sense of how you deal with one another and so forth, right? That actually enables us actually to engage in constructive communication and interaction. And that's what society is about. And as a matter of fact, the nation state was very important in the modern era in producing that kind of mentality in people. Because before there were nation states, people were pretty much confined to just their communities and just their families. And whenever they did run across strangers, they were to a large extent suspicious and fearful and had to in some way think themselves out of that state. But in fact, by living in a society, there's an enormous amount of taken for granted trust, you might say. But where does that come from? How is it actually maintained? And what sorts of things challenge it today? Because there are a lot of things, of course, that challenge it today. I want to leave a little time for some discussion about this. But I think the thing that's very important is that when we think about society, we're actually, to a large extent, we're thinking about people, for the most part, you will never have met, or maybe will never even meet, but in principle, you have some kind of relationship with. And here we're not just talking about strangers who you could possibly run across in a train, but also the people who produce your food, who produce, services and things that you rely on. You don't know who those people are either, but nevertheless, you do rely on them. There is some kind of implicit relationship that you have to such people, okay? And here, when you look at the early theorists of sociology, such as, you will maybe have run across them if you've studied them in school, right? There's Durkheim, Weber, right, Max Weber, and the main, the one you might have mostly heard of, Karl Marx. Okay, these are like the holy trinity of sociology in a way. All of these guys were flourishing in the late 19th, early 20th centuries when the nation state is beginning to kind of have a kind of significance in people's lives in a big way. And if you look at somebody like Marx, for example, he is very much preoccupied with exactly how do people relate to each other, including people you don't run across, the people who manufacture your things, right? The prices that you pay for the things that you have relate to how much how much of a wage people are being paid in the factories producing them. You may never meet those people, but nevertheless, the fact that you're paying a certain amount indicates the amount of value that's put on those people's work. Sociology tries to make sense of how that relationship arises, and Marx, of course, has one very powerful way that was very influential in the 20th century. Perhaps not so influential anymore, but nevertheless, this is kind of one kind of sociological perspective on things, namely the nature of the kinds of interactions and interdependencies that we have with other people in the world more generally. Now, for you younger people, I think the challenge that we face today is not only the fact that the nation state, which was something that preoccupied these guys, and in fact still preoccupies most of sociology, it's not only the nation state in a sense is not quite as important as it used to be. I mean, look at the low voter turnout for young people, right? In a way, it's kind of scandalous, but one of the things it does reflect is that people no longer, young people don't necessarily relate to that sense of society. So what is the sense of society that younger people relate to? Well, here it becomes very interesting and very important to explore the kinds of larger senses of society that are being opened up by information and communication technologies, right? The computer-mediated age in which all you guys were born into already, okay? And where us older people actually had to learn to be part of. And this in a very rapid period of time, over the course of less than a generation, basically, has ended up making you, in principle, interconnected with people throughout the world. Again, these are mostly people who you may never meet person in face-to-face, person-to-person. But at the same time, it creates a different kind of sense of society, but one where equally the sort of traditional issues of sociology are still important, such as how do bonds of trust, you know, form, right? To what extent are people dependent upon others? How do you actually value what people are doing when they're interacting with each other in an appropriate way? And we're just in the beginning of trying to make sense of this kind of larger, more global sense of society that's been made possible by information and communication technologies. And so this is kind of the challenge, you might say, for sociology in the front line in the 21st century, because in some sense, we have to kind of move our horizon of what it means to be social and what the society is from something that's geographically bounded, like a nation state, to this kind of larger and potentially, you know, infinitely expansive world of global networks, okay? And this is the world that you're inhabiting, and so from that standpoint, more than ever, you do need something like sociology in order to begin to make sense of things, because sociology is really the only field in the social sciences that's going to give you the large-scale perspective on this, right? That's going to try to understand everything from a sort of systemic, big perspective. And that's exactly the perspective in which you need to understand things today, even if you're talking about how do you make sense of your life, okay? And again, you know, if you want to understand what that means at a very personal level, you think about the controversies that are just emerging now over issues like privacy and surveillance, right? Where in a sense, anyone can have access to any data about you. What is that about, right? At one level, you're very personally, you know, impinged upon, maybe even threatened. But on the other hand, it also suggests the extent to which people's reach, and not just governments and not just Google, but hackers, all kinds of people, can have access to stuff far away from wherever they happen to live. Right? What does that do to the nature of society that we're actually involved in? Okay? And here you actually need some sociological awareness in order to be able to tackle this in a sophisticated way and to actually perhaps contribute to the larger discussions about how do we actually govern and regulate these processes that to a certain extent now we're sort of sleepwalking into, okay? So at this point, I want to start getting some feedback from the audience here as to where you are on this, because it's really not, you know, this is kind of like a mini lecture, but at the same time, I'd like to get a sense of where you're coming from and what your concerns are. Anyone can start, parents, students, anyone. Trust me, the first person who speaks will break the ice. Others will follow. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm already stupid here, by the way. So in terms of like, I'm like personally quite like religious, and I've come through like a lot of conflict with studying sociology, especially when you study like Marx and like religion within the capitalist society. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really opened me up to question all that, mm-hmm. which has been amazing. Mm-hmm. And in a strong sense, it's actually building my faith more.
Yes.
Which I think is like amazing. So.
Well, yes.
It's a constant conflict, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, you raise that point. It's very interesting because I think one of the reasons why there's been this kind of revival, you might say, of religious enthusiasm, especially in Christianity and Islam, has a lot to do with the fact that the nation state has traditionally been a secular body, right? And as the nation state becomes less and less powerful, it becomes kind of easier and easier for people of faiths, especially ones with universal aspirations, like Christianity and Islam, to sort of connect all over the world, right? The idea that global interconnection actually becomes a lot easier and a lot more natural to do. And so in a sense, I'm not very surprised about this. I mean, there was a tendency on the part of these guys in the 19th century to think that religion was a very parochial thing, right? It was just something for the family. It was just something for the community. It didn't really have a kind of global reach, right? That the global reach was secularism. But in fact, that's not the case at all, right? And in fact, we're now entering into a situation where I think, you know, certain religions, certainly Christianity and Islam, are showing the kind of global reach they do potentially have. And I think that is something that I think some sociologists are beginning to take quite seriously. Come on, other people. We got time. Come on, we got a little time, right?
We do.
This is a good question. Come on. There are others. You don't just have to be a student here to come up with questions like this. Are you surprised by what I say? Maybe you're just dumbfounded by what I said. I don't know what you guys thought sociology was, but this is what it is, especially as we think about it in the 21st century. Come on. Come on, people. Anyone. What are you doing here? Why do you want to study sociology?
Is there a need for sociology in an increasingly globalized world?
No, well, the answer is yes, right? But sociology has to reinvent itself in that context. That's the point, right? But sociology is the only social science that actually has this kind of very broad range, right, that we're talking about here. Because if you look at all the other kind of social sciences you might deal with, they tend to operate at a much sort of smaller scale. And so with sociology, we're talking about how whatever you're doing is actually interrelated to a whole bunch of other things going on in the world, not even just in your nation state. Yeah?
Although it's really interesting learning about sociology, do you see it in the near future helping with gender equality? Do you see the learning in the near future helping with the workplace?
Well, I do think, yes, I mean, I think one of the things that sociology has been stressing a lot, and this is where it all becomes a bit complicated, and we actually do a lot of this kind of stuff here, is that issues of gender aren't quite as straightforward as they used to be, okay? I mean, there was a time, let's say in the 1960s and 70s, where there was a kind of understanding that there was a sort of blanket discrimination against women that had to be dealt with, you know, legally, politically, etc. And the feminist movement was very important in kind of putting that on the table and actually getting a lot of legislation passed. But one of the things that you have now with a kind of second and third generation of this is that women, as they have become more integrated into the workforce and as they have been able to get into positions that they hadn't been able to get into in the past, is you're getting a fragmentation of what exactly, as it were, women need to do to improve their position in society. Right, so it's no longer kind of this monolithic thing, you know, that feminism stood for in the 60s and 70s about, you know, providing equal access to workplace and so forth. There's now a much more subtle kind of debate going on about this, and not all women are on the same side of the issue. Okay, and I think that's kind of one of the tricky issues that sociology, in effect, documents very well, is that you might say there are multiple feminisms floating around, and often these things are very much aligned with particular kind of class positions, ethnic positions, right? And so it becomes very difficult any longer to talk about in any kind of monolithic sense about how do you improve the condition of women.
Yeah. But do you also see feminism as a
political movement or as a more of a general?
Well, feminism, I think, you know, it's an interesting thing about, because this does relate to the kind of the history of sociology, right? There are a lot of movements like Marxism and feminism that in a way start off very strongly as political movements in many respects outside of the academy, outside of the university, right? But then over time become incorporated into it, right? And in a sense, the strongest voices for those movements become academics, right? And I think that's kind of the case with feminism today, to be perfectly honest, right? That the strongest voices for feminism are within the academy. Because I think it's within universities that women have actually made enormous amount of inroads, right? And when I'm not just talking in terms of, you know, the number. I mean, look at the people in this room, right? Most of them are women,
yeah.
Right? And that's very common in sociology, right? Where we have intakes of 80% women. That's not uncommon at all, and that across universities. And also women are very, very prominent in senior administration of universities and things like that. And so I would say that, you know, within sociology and within, you know, the academic world more generally, women are actually a very strong force, you know? So if you want to know where the bastion of feminism is in today's world, I would say university, you know?
And also more of a general question, I wasn't able to study sociology at A-level. Do you think that's going to put me at a massive disadvantage?
No, we always presume ignorance. No, I mean, the thing is, this is one of the reasons why, because I do think, I mean, the reason why I started off by mentioning Margaret Thatcher and this business about there's no such thing as society is I think a lot of people of your generation have drunk the Kool-Aid on this, right? Right. In other words, I think a lot of people kind of aren't quite sure what society means anymore, right? And where the boundaries are and who's in it and who's out of it and so forth. And I think one of the kind of benchmarks of that is this debate that this country's having over immigration. Who belongs here? Right? I mean, that's a very peculiar kind of debate to have, but I think one of the things that it points to is the fact that people no longer have any clear intuitions about what a society is, because they're not so sure who belongs, who doesn't belong, how you judge who belongs, right? And people are coming up with all kinds of strange views as a result of that. And here I think sociology can offer some kind of guidance. Mm-hmm. Other? See, if one person can do it, others can do it. Yes?
When you talk about globalization, and obviously Marx and Durkheim, their views are still valued today, but obviously the world's changed a lot since they wrote. So do you think their ideas can still be applied as much as they could be applied?
I think it's a big problem. I think what you're pointing to is a big problem. This is where I think you might say that sociology is kind of provides an invitation, especially for younger people, to reconceptualize some of the fundamental notions. Because it's no doubt, it's true, Marx, Durkheim, and Weber are primarily reflecting on late 19th century experience, okay? And even if we're talking about something like capitalism, which of course is still around today, it's a different kind of capitalism from what it was back in the late 19th century, especially if you start thinking about that what, you know, Marx thought the proletariat who were going to lead the revolution were going to be industrial workers. And if you want to talk about the 21st century, I don't think industrial workers are going to be the main players. Right? There's a sense in which industrial workers are precisely the kind of people we're trying to find new lives for. Right? So there's a sense in which if we're going to, as it were, maintain what's of value, because I do believe, of course, there's stuff of value from Marx, Durkheim, and Weber. So for example, the Marxist concept of exploitation, the exploitation of labor, that's certainly a real issue. Right? But how that issue actually gets played out, right, is going to be something that needs to be rethought in light of the different ways in which our economies are running in the 21st century, in terms of how we're able actually to extract value from people's labor and stuff like that. It's not the same as it was in the 19th century. And this is where I think there's a real interesting challenge for younger people to kind of come in and sort of reinvent these concepts, which is true, are pretty much things of the 19th century. So when you learn about these guys, part of what you end up learning is 19th century history, right? The Industrial Revolution, stuff like this, right? But of course, you're living in the 21st century, right, where the whole basis for the economy has shifted, but that doesn't mean that issues like exploitation go away, or even issues like class, even if class is formed on a somewhat different basis. And that's where there's a kind of real opportunity, it seems to me, for younger people to enter into sociology. Yes?
But do you think issues of exploitation are those relevant due to the decline of
declining the working class, or the argument there has been a declining the working class?
Well, look, I think the thing here is how do you... see, because look, one of the, if you look at the way in which Marx dealt with exploitation, I mean, there were kind of easy ways of measuring in terms of people working in factories for certain numbers of hours and then getting very kind of minimum wages, right? The way in which we would measure exploitation now would have to be a little more sophisticated, because in a sense, the immediate problems that Marx was talking about have been dealt with in certain ways, right? So we do have things like minimum wage laws, we do have restricted number of hours in which people can work, right? There are unions still around, right? There is bargaining power, right? A lot of the things that Marx could not presuppose when he did his analysis have in fact been put into place. But there are other forms of exploitation that meanwhile have arisen, right, since the time of Marx, which Marx never had to conceptualize. You know, so for example, all this stuff about unpaid labor for internships, right? And this kind of general sort of idea that's very much, very strong in the society, right? That in a sense you have to be able to work for a while before you can get paid. Right? I mean, you might think, well, that's a kind of, you know, that's not something that ever crossed Marx's horizon, right? But nevertheless, you might argue that stuff like that might start falling into the category of exploitation. And I would say there are other things too, right? I mean, for people who work in the kind of fields that we work in, so academic fields, so-called intellectual work, right? Time isn't monitored very closely. People end up actually spending enormous amounts of hours doing stuff. Right, and a lot of that time isn't actually registered in terms of payment. It's just taken for granted you should be doing it. And so much of work these days has this kind of character to it, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing teachers are always complaining about, right? That in a sense their salaries don't actually reflect the amount of time they're actually spending preparing for courses and things of that kind. And it seems to me that these are kind of the emergent forms of exploitation that somebody like Marx didn't really properly conceptualize because it wasn't really an issue for him. But which I think is still very much an issue for us today. And so there's so I do think the concept does have value. It's just how you measure it, how you track it, I think is quite tricky. Heather? Come on, guys. Don't be bashful. Yes?
If you're looking at a globalized world, you'd think that obviously, like being like third world countries, we'd be able to help them more. Then there's issues like Boko Haram, and that first thing, obviously the media showed it a lot, but it's still a problem, but we haven't really done anything to help. So you think being in a globalized world would help us, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, I think this is a really tricky issue, right? In terms of, because when we talk about globalization, we're really talking about, you might say, the reach of our networks, but we're not necessarily saying universalization. We're not necessarily caring about everybody in the world. It's just that the people we care about might be very far away from us, right? So all our friends in Tokyo or someplace, you know, that have lifestyles very similar to us or something like that. And so when we're dealing with these issues in Africa, well, those problems, in a sense, are just as bad as they've ever been, actually. And I think there are additional kinds of questions that arise, right? And in a sense, the Boko Haram thing illustrates this, namely, one thing that is true, and it's a very striking feature, and this is where, you know, if you go into sociology and you look at the way information and communication technology has changed the world, right? If you go to these third world countries in Africa, you often find that something like mobile phone penetration is higher than it is in a place like the United States, right? So these people actually have media, right? They can transmit stuff. And in fact, part of the power of a groups like that is their ability to be able to transmit and to make very vivid kind of the atrocities they're committing, which of course then completely destabilizes, you know, world opinion and action and stuff like that. But that kind of power that you can end up getting from being able to transmit stuff through the media doesn't necessarily translate into any kind of politically useful or economically useful action, right? And I think that that's, in a way, it illustrates one of the problems that I think faces us in this increasingly interconnected world. Yes, you can find out when all kinds of atrocities are committed 30 minutes after they happen in all the television channels. And you can even have the people committing the atrocities being more than happy to do selfies about it, right? I mean, all of that is true, right? So you know more about the world than you ever have before, but it doesn't necessarily increase your capacity to do anything about it. And so I think there's a real disconnect, you might say, between that kind of publicity that a group like Boko Haram can get, you know, and the available political means to do anything about it. And I would say this is also true, you know, economic means as well, right? Because from the standpoint of people who might invest in the developing world, right? These kinds of politically destabilizing situations that you see in Africa do not help business, right? Because at the end of the day, what you're talking about, people wanting to invest, and they're going to invest in a place where there's constantly, you know, possibilities of kidnapping and tribal wars and all the rest of it going on, okay? So I do think those are quite, you might say, traditional modern problems of the developing world that have not gone away, but in a way get sort of amplified a bit by the presence of by our ability to know about it. Other questions, issues? Come on. There's so much more to talk about here. Come on, guys. Yes?
Do you think every politician should do at least a short course in sociology before they...
Well, you sort of wonder what they do know. I do think so. I mean, you know, if you... You know, in this country, it's interesting because if you go in the European continent and Latin America especially, you actually see a relatively high percentage of politicians who actually have had some sociology background. I'm thinking about a former president of Brazil who had been Cardozo, who was a friend of Anthony Giddens, the great British sociologist. And in the European continent, you also see such things. But what you don't see that so much in this country. Primarily because of this tradition of, you know, the PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics that Oxford pioneered, where you do those three subjects together. We actually have that here too now. And I think that took a lot of, and so if you look at people like Ed Balls or Ed Miliband in the Labour Party in particular, that's the background they come from, okay? But Miliband's father, Ralph Miliband, was a sociologist, right? He was a Marxist sociologist, okay? So obviously, yes, sociology is very important. And in fact, if you look at when labor governments have been in power, sociology has been very prominent in framing the issues on welfare policy and stuff like that. And when the Tories have been in power, usually it's been economics that has been framing them, right? So the point is that sociology historically has had a role, perhaps not as prominent a role in the education of the politicians per se, but I think certainly at the policy level, in terms of how you frame policy issues, sociology, certainly on the left of the political spectrum, has had a very significant role. Other issues? Come on, people. All these questions are fine. Not a bad question in the bunch. We can have more. Yeah?
This is kind of, I don't want to repeat the questions that were said earlier, but it's going off quite the idea of Marx maybe being a bit outdated.
Yeah.
Do you ever think there will be a time when you'll just have to say it's no longer relevant, like, at all? Because as society's obviously moving on, there are less and less ideas of, like, Karl Marx's original kind of theories that can maybe be applied.
Yeah, I mean, I do think so. In fact, I'm already of this view, to be honest with you. I mean, I think the thing that's still important about Marx is that Marx is culturally very important and politically very important in terms of getting, you know, as long as people are being taught about Marx, let's say at the level, you know, at the secondary school level, it does become important as kind of a linchpin to get people to think about issues. But I do think ultimately you do need theories and theorists that are suited for the century in which we live. And while I do think there are some very important concepts from Marx that can be taken, exploitation, I think, has not gone away. In fact, I think some of his most critical concepts still have a lot of value. I do think that some of the framing of the issues, right, do need to change, okay? And I do think, you know, if we are always talking about exploitation in terms of industrial labor, I don't think we're going to quite catch the kind of work that people are actually likely to do in the 21st century in a very effective way. So in that sense, we do really need to move kind of the mindset from the 19th century to the 21st century. And I think eventually that does mean look at it this way, right? In economics, right, the person who founded economics is Adam Smith, right? You know about Adam Smith and capitalism, Wealth of Nations. That was published in 1776, okay? That's a classic work. It laid out all the invisible hand, all this stuff that you hear Tories talking about all the time. All came from Adam Smith. But if you're a practicing economist, you don't talk about Adam Smith. right? You know, you've gone beyond him. You don't need to mention him. He's of only historical interest. But the concepts are still there, right? The concepts are still there. They're still being used by economists in a much more rigorous, much more up-to-date fashion. And that's kind of my view about Marx, basically, right? It's not that you say, you know, Marx was wrong in some, you know, definitive sense. No, but you say Marx is very much a man of his time. And we're in a different time, and so what we have to do is we have to learn how to pick up what's valuable of Marx and bring it to our time. And I think this discipline, sociology, I think has only been so far partially successful in doing that. I think there is a certain amount of nostalgia for the 19th century in sociology, in a way. But I think that gradually we're moving. And I think what's really shifting people's thinking is actually this, the globalization of the economy and the way in which the basis on which wealth and value is produced is changing quite radically very quickly. I think that's, so in a sense, yeah, we're going to have to say Marxist history at some point. Yes? I mean, look, I do think that there is a, you know, so the growing inequality between the rich and the poor, this kind of thing, of course, that's still with us. That's something that needs to be dealt with. And that is a feature of capitalism. That is something he discovered. So that no, not taking that away. But I do think that the dynamic that he imagined on the back of that is wrong, right? In other words, I actually don't see a proletariat arising. Yes, there is a bigger gap between the rich and the poor, but Marx thought that was sufficient actually to get the communist revolution off the ground, more or less, right? That once people recognized the extent of the inequality and that more and more people were becoming more and more impoverished, that itself would spark the revolution. And what, you know, the communists had to do was just organize the people, right? That was kind of what the whole communist movement was about. But it seems to me that was wrong, okay? It seems to me, it may have been right for a certain amount of time, because you know Marx actually thought the revolution was going to start in Germany, which had the most successfully organized labor movement, right? That's where he thought the revolution was going to happen. So he sort of imagined this wouldn't be too hard because it would happen in a country where these inequalities were growing, but where labor was already pretty well organized. But of course, it didn't happen there, because Bismarck created the social security system, which provided a kind of buffer so that people never got too poor because they were always getting handouts from the state. And that kind of kept them quiet. I mean, that's basically how you got the welfare state, okay? But the point is it happened in Russia, and then in Russia it took a totally different dynamic in a way. That's the thing. And so the question is now, we're in the beginning of the 21st century. Where is this proletariat that's going to organize itself? Because see, this is where I think the business about information and communication technology, the social media side of this, can be very misleading. Because of course, it is possible for people through social media to organize themselves, you know, and say, we're going to gather together in this square, and we're going to make a lot of noise against, you know, the dictator, you know, or the G7, or whomever, right? And it gets a lot of, you know, media coverage, right? And they break a few windows, and a few people get arrested, and then it's back to normal. Right? Everything goes back to normal, right? Because what happens is that this social media, this ability to organize, to stage events, does not have any follow-through in terms of an organized political movement, right? And this is what Marx was always very concerned about, and this is what the communists were very good at. They organized people. It wasn't just have a riot or have a demonstration and then go home, right? They were constantly organizing, mobilizing, and infiltrating things. That's why, you know, it was, and that's why people found them so dangerous. But what happens now is, no, you have these kind of social media protests, right? Which, you know, which last for a couple of days, and then everybody goes home. And meanwhile, business continues as usual. You see what I mean?
But why does that happen? Why do people?
Well, because as I was saying earlier, I think there's a false sense of freedom that's come from the social media. I think because people can find out more about what's happening around the world, they somehow think they have more power over events. And that doesn't follow, right? And even if you gather together and you have a protest, and you know, look at the Occupy movement, right? That's a great example, because that lasted a little longer than some of the rest of them, okay? But that really hasn't had any effect, okay? And it's because there's no connection between those social media kind of revolts and real political action in the more traditional sense, right? Where you actually are able to change things through the normal political processes. There's not that, in fact, the people who tend to do the social media style politics tend to be very disaffected, tend not even to vote, right? They tend to be very much against the political establishment, and so there's no way in which you can get any kind of joined up action over this. And that's why the Arab Spring has been the way it is, right? The Arab Spring has been just one failure after another. Other?
We have time for a couple more
questions. Yeah, come on, guys. This is real stuff we're talking about here. Come on. Don't be shy. Yes.
Kind of like going off that question about like the social media and protesting, do you think that that's now allowed people to maybe feel like they're actually protesting but maybe not realistically doing anything? Because, you know, they have all like the Boko Haram thing, like bring back our girls, like many people just kind of did the hashtag but then never really did that.
Yeah,
so do you think social media has given people a platform to do something but then not many people actually?
Yeah, it's the Band-Aid effect. Right, remember Band-Aid, 1984, you know, Bob Geldof, and, you know, we're going to save Africa by having a few, you know, new romantic pop stars sing an awful song. I mean, you know, and then if we do it every 10 years, this is like, you know, it's like a rain dance, right? It's like a rain dance, this stuff, right? Where people kind of go there, they make a lot of noise for a while, you know, a few pounds fall from the heavens, and then nothing happens. And even Geldof, most recently, has been forced to admit this. And I think there's a sense in which this was, in other words, this was already happening even before we got to the hashtag world that we're in now. This was already beginning to happen where this kind of sense of, you know, trying to capitalize on some media that people pay a lot of attention to, like pop music and things in the 1980s, that could be a vehicle by which we could save the world. This was a very popular idea back then, right? And then it kind of moved into social media more generally. And the problem is there's not sufficient follow through. Right, so even if you're able to collect a large amount of money over a short period of time, right, nobody's really monitoring how the money's being used properly. There's, you know, and the money only goes so far, and there's no way of kind of recapturing it. I mean, there's been studies done, media studies done, about, you know, this phenomenon about, okay, if you broadcast on television some atrocity happening in a developing country, for a short period of time, you actually do get a lot of people contributing some money and things. But as soon as that goes off the television radar, and it's no longer big news, it drops immediately. It is that dependent on the publicity. You'd have to be, and then the problem is if you actually kept that stuff on the airwaves all the time, then you get this other kind of media effect problem that it no longer seems so significant, it just becomes background noise. Ah, yes, another bunch of people murdered today, yes, but that's kind of what they do in that part of the world, right? You know, I mean, I think that you could end up becoming numb and desensitized if you end up finding out about it all the time as well. So there's a real difficult problem here, it seems to me, that just knowing about all these atrocities happening does not by itself translate into any kind of effective action. You know, and I do think there is a kind of mismatch between the technologies we use to communicate things and the ways in which we actually engage in political action. I just don't think those things are very well joined up these days. Yeah.
So how do you think like we can in fact save the world, and how do you think sociology helps towards that, or can help towards that?
Well, first of all, I think one thing that sociology will tell you, I mean, and this is the kind of thing I've been trying to tell you, is that it'll give you a measure of the problem. That's the first point. You have to realize the problem for what it really is. Because I do think the reason why we do get into these kind of hashtag politics and things like this is that people do not have a sufficiently sophisticated understanding of how all this stuff works. And so that's the first thing you need. You need a joined up understanding of what the problems are. And that in one sense, we can find out about more things in the world, right? And we can, as it were, display our responses to them in a sense. But what we can't necessarily do is control the flow of events if we're not hooked up into normal political economic structures. And so the question then becomes, how do you do that? And this is why I think it would be a great idea that if people are thinking about going into politics, you know, and the job of the politician being to kind of make those connections, right? In other words, look at where people are sort of expressing their opinions and things and try to hook that up into the normal political process, that they actually study sociology, right? That, so, you know, in this sense, I agree with the premise of the question very strongly, that you know, a politician actually should learn sociology, because that, it seems to me, is a real you know, substantive problem in the world today. Because obviously, it's not that hard to get people to become agitated about stuff happening around the world. That's not hard to do at all, right? The question is to channel it in some kind of productive way. And you need to have a sociological perspective to see the full measure of the problem. And if you want to go into something like politics or policy making or something like that, this is the kind of field that you could do it in.
We have five more minutes, so...
Yeah, so please.
Has something
we're not in a rush here, guys.
No.
I was going to say, back to raising funds, I was listening to a report on the Philippines where they released and a lot of money went over spending, not always appropriate, but because it all became in quite a rush, it was difficult to appropriate the right funds in the right places, but also created brilliant communities of very, very hard-working people who sustained themselves into turning some of them into those that felt they were entitled.
Yeah.
Sort of feeling of entitlement. And maybe, I don't know, I'm just thinking maybe that can worship itself into the sort of benefit state we have here of entitlement and keeping people in a certain situation. And not, I mean, I know it's very much sort of a generalising, and it's not that simple, but just where there is disaster funds and a lot of money, isn't always the best thing to push it out, because it can alter the way that people are actually managing their own lives.
Well, no, you're raising a really good point. In fact, that's why it's actually something I've been very concerned about, because there are, one of the things that you will learn, if you do look at things like the sociology of development aid, is that there are actually many different kinds of views on the table about what's the best way to go about this, because there has been this tradition of just kind of throwing money at the situation and assuming that that's going to somehow help things, when in fact, if you don't really engage very substantively with the lives of the people as they normally are and so forth, that you're not really going to have any kind of substantial effect. But then the question is, how do you actually get access to that? And what sorts of development aid people will actually be willing to, as it were, spend the time and spend the effort and so forth to do it? I mean, I'll give you an example. You might be interested in this. There's a book, it's actually not by sociologists though, but it kind of addresses your point. It's a book called Poor Economics. It's by economists, strangely enough. Poor Economics, a couple of economists at MIT. And what they found was kind of the, because they basically tried many different strategies to try to provide development aid to people in Africa they're primarily working with. And they found that the biggest problem that they faced, or at least one of the biggest problems they faced, was getting people to kind of, first of all, see the aid as something that wasn't disruptive. That was the first problem. And then the second problem was, if they didn't see it as disruptive, how to actually take on board the lessons that the aid provides. So in other words, beyond the handout, what do you need to do in order to provide for yourself in the appropriate way? That was very difficult to do within their own kind of, within their own kind of cultural framework. And very often, the only way this kind of thing worked was by some of the people from, let's say, a village, would actually study in a Western country for a while, so they, as it were, have a bit of both worlds in them, and then come back and then instruct them. But this kind of approach, while it actually is effective, is actually very labor intensive, you might say, because it means you actually have to invest in the place in a serious way, and you have to provide education for these people in a very serious fashion. But it also gets accused of being imperialist. Because inevitably what happens is that when these native people start to internalize the principles of, how to organize themselves, their economies and so forth, they become, quote, westernized in some fashion. And that then becomes a kind of cultural issue, especially for neighboring villages and things like that. So it's a very tricky kind of thing in a way, I'm sympathetic with the idea, but it really, it's not so straightforward how you actually help these people in those places without actually substantially changing their culture and their lifestyles.
And that you don't want to quell people's generosity.
Right, well, that's right. Well, that's right. That's right. Oh, no, that's right. Yeah, and in fact, you want to encourage people, in a sense, to continue to do this, too. Yes. No, I agree.
I think we need to wrap up now.
Okay.
We're almost out of time.
All right.
But thank you so much, Steven.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for your questions. They were very good.